Hi, everybody. Welcome to Who Cares About the Rock Hall, a podcast about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I'm your host, Joe Quazala. I know entirely too much about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but that is the show's premise, and that is potentially why you're listening. With me, as always, is the skeptic, the voice of the people, the little devil on my shoulder, Kristen Studdard. Hey, Kristen.
Hi. Also, potentially why people are listening.
We won't take that out of the equation. We won't discount that. That is, you know, we will give you proper due. Yes, you are half of this. So
come for my wild takes. Let's go.
See if Kristen will remember anything that we talked about last week. That's really
Oh God. Oh no, is there gonna be a quiz?
No, it's just, you know. I mean, yes. do you remember that you have a problem remembering? Is that an oxymoron?
I think so.
Okay. Well, we're in the thick of ballot season. It's out. We're doing our artist episodes. I'm very excited to bring in our guest today, someone who I've occasionally corresponded with over the years. I'm glad it's finally happening. This guy has been on the nominating committee for, based on my calculations, 18 years. Our listeners might recognize his name and voice because once upon a time he would reveal the nominees on Sirius XM. He's also got a podcast with OG MTV VJ Mark Goodman called Sound Up.
Mark Goodman.
We've got Alan Light with us. Hey, Alan.
Hello. Hi, you guys. Happy to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Of course. Glad, as you said, glad we finally lined it up.
Yeah.
Stars aligned and here we are.
Here we are.
Years on the nomcom. Well, well, well. And you're
that's longer than I would have guessed, but I'm gonna defer to you.
From the information
time does pass on.
Yeah, 2006.
Not way off.
If that sounds right to you, I mean that's what I am seeing. So that's quite some
time. At
least
it's, you know, 15 I would have said yes for sure. 18 uh-huh. starts to sound like a scary duration, but
right. Well, we count for the pandemic, and you're like, okay, well then maybe that does make sense. We lost some time there,
a few years. So anyway,
but also to stay on, I just feel like there's been many a shakeup in the nomcom over the years, and you've survived. You're still in there. So I guess congratulations.
Well, I'll take that, and I guess I was sort of second wave on the committee. I guess I sort of think about it that there was, you know, obviously the extreme esteemed veterans who started it and set the path down. And then when that started to cycle through, I sort of came in, you know, in that next wave and that, you know, and those do continue. I mean, we can talk about that. We continue to tweak the composition of the committee. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when it's determined that my time has come, then I will, it's so be it. This is what happens, but I still am happy to be a part of the game.
You're not offering yourself up.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. I'm not throwing myself on the fire.
No.
So I've got to imagine, you know, let's talk about before you joined. Were you a voter for a time before you had joined the committee?
Yeah, I would have been. I certainly can't tell you when that would have started, but I was a voter for some length of time before joining the committee. And I really remember, I was thinking about it the other day, I started my career, I interned at Rolling Stone between my junior and senior year of college, and then I came back and worked initially in the fact-checking department at Rolling Stone, and then writing more and more and became a senior writer there. And that's all in the sort of late 80s, early 90s. And I remember early on in my fact-checking days, fact-checking the program for the, you know, second or third, because the deal was if you would contribute to the fact-checking effort, they would slide you a seat at some distant table for the ceremony.
Nice.
And so it was the year that the Kinks went in and Wilson Pickett went in, and I think it's probably 1990.
1990, yeah.
Yeah, so it's, you know, just a... And that's the first that I would have committed.
At like the Waldorf at
that? Oh, yeah, yeah. It was still at the Waldorf for quite a while at that point. I mean, Prince is still at the Waldorf. So, but that's, you know, whatever. My first association or affiliation and the first time that I would have gone to a ceremony goes back a really scary amount of time.
Yeah, I mean, not only is that Waldorf, but that's, in my opinion, more memorably Jam era. where where it's not produced
like
for
true
television.
wild jam era.
Free for all. I was not there for the, you know, Dylan, George and Ringo, you know, Keith, like that. It was not that year, but it was, but yes, when that, when it still all ended in a free for all was.
Yeah. There's something, you know, oddly charming about that, that era and its beautiful mess is how I'll put it.
Fair enough. Glad that I got to witness it. Not sure, you know, had its many charms, but sometimes felt like you would be there all, truly all night.
Yeah, not produced for television. There's there's probably no stage manager keeping things moving. It's just however long it takes.
So yeah, so I was, so those were early sort of, I was around for a lot of the formative stuff at Rolling Stone as it was taking shape and taking flight. And then at some point was, you know, added to the voter rolls and then joined the committee. Whenever the hell it is you say, I did.
Yeah, and this was not as a result of a campaign to join the committee. This was just you got the call. I'm assuming. I mean, there's a bit of a pipeline from Rolling Stone to the committee to some degree.
Yeah, I mean, I had obviously long been. I left Rolling Stone. I was one of the founding editors of Vibe magazine. I was the editor in chief there. We acquired Spin. I was the editor in chief there. I launched my own magazine. That published for a couple of years until our money went away. And this isn't until after all of that, that I was brought onto the committee. But I, you know, I am one of the few who's able to say that I left Rolling Stone, you know, on good terms, on good terms with Jan, on good terms with, you know, the company. And so, you know, even when I was going and doing other things, you know, I was, that was always when I was freelancing again, certainly I was brought back into do stuff there. And, you know, I never cut ties with the place and they never dumped me. So yes, I would have still been within that orbit.
The friendly, the yeah. Inner circle. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, so the nominating committee used to, convene, as we understand, at the Rolling Stone offices. It's now at the iHeart offices, and you know, you have seen changes as we have seen changes. Awesome.
That's just like, I would say that is such an emblematic, just that shift. To that shift, you know, from it being at the Rolling Stone offices to being at the iHeart radio offices. Are they just called iHeart Media now? I think, right?
Whatever. Yeah, and yeah. John Sykes, whatever his title is at iHeart, but as a you know, one of the top executives at iHeart, is now the chairman of the board for the Hall of Fame. So mostly these are, you know, conference rooms that nobody has to pay extra rental space for. So I would, you know, it's not like they are chosen out of, you know, they're chosen because of they're easily at hand for
just
the
meaning like the seat of power has shifted, you know, the capital is no longer Rome. Like that is what I'm saying. Like, I feel like that is when did that happen, when Sykes became the chairman?
Yeah, I can't remember the exact sequence. Rolling Stone moved out of the offices at 1290 Sixth Avenue, where those meetings always had been. When they, you know, after the sale to Penske, and so they moved into different offices, and John took over chairing the board, and somewhere out of all of that, the location moved. And I wouldn't read whatever symbolism in it you choose. That's fair enough, but I don't think there was any particular strategic.
Oh yeah, I don't think of it as like anybody had like a big, you know, chessboard out trying to figure out how to get their hands on the, you know, the hall. I just mean it like, oh wow, we really have shifted away from the seat of power being Rolling Stone, which had been for so long. Yeah. I guess just traditionally. So, I mean, you know, obviously because of its founding.
And yeah, I mean, I think where the question was going, I think I haven't really, you know, there hasn't been any particular structural shift in the way that the meetings are conducted. They've sort of been different pieces that have formalized over the years, but it hasn't really ever sort of radically been redone, certainly during my tenure, of how the meeting operates, which is, Everybody preps and brings their two picks to the table, and they're kicked around and debated, and the votes are tallied up at the end and a ballot comes out of that. That has not, you know, the composition of the committee has obviously changed. People have gone off. People have come on. The location has changed. But the way that the meeting runs, I don't think has gone through any particularly drastic transformation.
Mm-hmm. It's funny, we haven't had like a minutia conversation in a while. Like in the beginning of the show when we were talking to nominating committee members, this was all brand
new.
Like,
what's it like? What happens
behind at the chamber?
And yeah. it's giant. I do know that there is a big sandwich that goes down the center of the table.
That's never been true. That's never been true.
That I know.
It's in Kristen's head. And
that there's a big. There's
I will
a sub,
not speak. I will allow the sandwich. The visions myth. Of sandwiches to dance in your head.
One long sandwich down the middle of the table. I know this.
This myth comes from the fact that some of the old timers from the Seymour Stein days, including Seymour Stein himself, on this very show, would always bring up the catering from, I believe, Carnegie Deli. It was always like, it felt like that was sometimes more important than the proceedings at hand.
Definitely part of the ritual.
And then I know that there was a thing for a while. I mean, I'm trying to remember again. I don't remember almost anything, but I know that like with people are not allowed to zoom in again. Yeah. Is that like back to it or has that changed?
I mean, obviously it changed during, you know, during Zoom years, it was whatever we could do. And it is wildly, you know, it is very much discouraged. The reality is that there are some touring musicians who are on the committee where, you know, that's, you got to address it as it happens. People get sick. I mean, in a COVID world.
Yeah, so and now it's not like people aren't, you know, like, oh, they weren't dedicated enough to come in sick. Everyone's like, please stay home.
It is very much a focus on, you know, everybody that can be in the room should be in the room. I can't say that's 100% when there are reasons, you know, mitigating factors. This year there was a snowstorm. Some of the LA people were trapped and actually couldn't get in. And some just made it on delays and just made it. And some were not going to be able to get there. And so that's, you know, you're not going to penalize somebody for that.
Mm-hmm. Right. Interesting. You've survived one, what they called the purge, which I think was around 2015. We've talked to a lot of the purged members from the nominated committee, and that is their phrasing. I know that there was a not purge level change this past year. We just talked to Danielle Smith, who is now on the committee with you. Do we find these types of changes are, there's been a lot of, if we're being candid about the hall, women and diversity in general. It seems like these changes are kind of on the right path in that regard.
Yeah, look, I'm glad that Danielle came on and I'm glad that she offered it up because I'm thrilled to my very, very long time friend and colleague Danielle is part of this process. I'm delighted by that, but everybody has their own level of comfort about whether they reveal that they're there or not. So I don't want to put anything out that they don't put out themselves.
Wise move.
The
shadowy cabal.
Yeah. But look, the reality is, of course, we know what that the institution has always looked to evolve. And that needs to go through the voting body. That needs to go through the nominating committee. That, you know, that you need to continue to refresh and keep up with and, try to mirror the history and the story as best you can. And I think that, I think recently that those who are in charge of these decisions and putting the committee together and making those asks and everything else, I love everybody who's come on this year. I think there were great additions that really represented not just gender diversity, not just racial diversity, but also stylistic diversity. Mm-hmm. Also people who are in from sort of different corners of the music community and speaking for different constituencies and different communities. And look, it should not be the same, the same guys are there forever, hammering out the same fights decade after decade. you know, I don't know, I don't know that it needs to be formalized or that it would be appropriate to formalize in term limits. But I think as an idea, there's a certain point where you feel like, you know, I've had my say, I've had my shot. You don't want to lose the institutional memory. Obviously, you want to retain some connectivity to how this thing has evolved and to where it has come from and to, okay, these are things we've talked about in earlier years, and this is the way that's played out, and, you know, be able to think about it within the sort of institutional framework. But I don't think that you want that to just calcify and never move and not recognize the those who are eligible change, those who you want to be coming to the museum change. You know, all of this stuff is a living and evolving thing, and that should be recognized. And I'm really happy with, you know, certainly the recent steps taken to try to address that. And you can't keep adding. I mean, that's the other thing is you can't just have, you know, all of a sudden there's twice as many people in the room. It's an entirely different thing. I mean, it's got to be a manageable number to be able to do this as a meeting. So if it isn't strictly one in, one out, you need to sort of keep an eye on that so that it doesn't just completely spiral out of control. And that's, you know, that, and everybody recognizes that.
I want to say you may have been there in years where, because I think the number now is not quite as, you know, maybe the number's been pretty stable since you've been there, but I think there were some years in the beginning and maybe kind of the middle period where it seemed like there were way too many people. And I don't know if you ever experienced that where it was like, this is getting out of control.
If everybody brings two, we've got
right.
It's exponential.
So all of those are just those are the realities of it. And everybody who's been there and is no longer there is great. And everybody that's been coming in, I'm really, really happy with. It's not about the worth of those people, you know, their ideas, their contributions. Every year, I think all of us walk away. You know, this sounds really cliched, but I'm sure you've heard it. Excited and inspired that everybody kind of brings their A game, takes this really seriously, brings in reasoned selections, makes their case. Some I agree with, some I don't agree with, but nobody gets the floor and then, you know, doesn't bring anything. And I think that's always, you know, it's just always a rewarding thing to feel like, okay, I am the first to grant this is an imperfect process. I think anybody would agree it's an imperfect process, but I can't come up with a better way to do it other than continuing to improve the ways that we do it, which I think we continue to do.
That's great. Well said. you don't have to answer this question. Do you want to take credit for anybody on the ballot this year?
I will be honest and say this year that I cannot take credit for anybody on the ballot and that the people that I brought in did not make the ballot.
Are you open to sharing those names?
I guess that I will, since this is just me. Sure. I will say, you know, without, yeah. The ones that I brought in this year, I brought back the White Stripes and I brought in Outkast.
God bless you.
Oh my God.
Those are who I brought. I'm not going to have them.
You don't have to say anything else, but I'm just glad. I mean,
listeners to our show know that we have found the Outkast snub in particular to be egregious.
Mystifying.
Snub, whatever. You know, I won't rehash the debate, but I will say those are what I brought. And you know what? It's what I always say. It's a long game. You know, we know that.
I'm glad to know they're in the mix in the room. It's wild that wasn't enough, but just saying their name didn't.
And I recognize that it's tricky because you know we're backed up on Tribe Called Quest. You know, I can't argue with them getting another shot. That that there's support for them and that they've gotten there. I can't, you know, Rakim is maybe my favorite, maybe the greatest MC of all time. I'm certainly not going to argue against Eric B and Rakim being on that ballot. And the reality of you don't want to split it a million ways within any particular genre, or you give the voters an impossible job. So no, you know, I completely understand all of those things, but I expect that I will bring that back and fight for it again next time.
Yeah, I'm surprised that neither of those were included. So we do a draft every year, and like we always draft. I mean, how long?
It's who we think is going to be on the ballot.
Yeah, it's like who we think was going to be on the ballot, and I have drafted Outkast many times. They are usually
as have I since we started this show, yeah. Since they became eligible. It's and the one thing that we. That I think both of us share this opinion, which is that like it's interesting that the Hall seems to clear a path for newly eligible hip hop artists that are superstars like Eminem and Jay-Z, but have not done the same for Outkast. That's all I'll say. They are at a level where it seems like you put them on the ballot, they're going to do well the same way that we put Missy Elliott or that we put, whoever of these newly eligible superstar hip hop artists and to put them on the back burner because of people who chronologically should come first,
To that point, I'll just say that I backed out of Outkast last year because of Missy going to the ballot. Mm-hmm. And I said, I'll push because if Missy goes, that's going to happen. Take the win.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I don't think that we should step on that. And so it's okay. We come back and do it again next year. It's all right.
Like I say, I'm glad to hear that they're being mentioned. I am shocked. I'm surprised, I think we talk about this all the time and everything. And it's just like, I think sometimes in rock, the like more guitar based rock genre has gone out of order all the time, and I think like you, it, I don't know. I love Tribe. We also always advocate for them. They're amazing. Great. The thirst for them or the appetite for them, with the voters.
We'll see.
I don't get hung up on the chronology stuff so much.
You can't.
And everybody has their own perspective on this. And I understand all the feelings like, of course, this one should go in before this one. Mm-hmm. But you just back, you endlessly back yourself up. And particularly in the earlier years, I was clearly brought in to be one of the purposes was to sort of be a hip hop advocate. That mm-hmm. was the world that I, came out of and having edited Vibe. And that's what I did at Rolling Stone. And I think that especially early on, those of us who were sort of from that wing of the committee really did sort of look, try to view it tactically and try to find where are the wins? This may leapfrog somebody chronologically, but if we can get them in, let's get them in. We'll sort it out later. Let's get more bodies representing this genre in, and along the way we can go back and fill in, as long as the story adds up the right way down the road, let's not freeze people who could get in in the name of people that are going to be harder to get in.
Right, because you wind up getting zero when you could have gotten one. Like, I think a hip-hop induction for anyone is good for any further hip-hop inductee. It's just you take the wins where you can get them.
And that's true in general. I think that that's been true. I think that one thing that's been that was really a bad spot for us for a long time, which I'm sure you've also discussed, is the sort of post-punk space. I think that for a while we did a terrible job of, let's try The Cure. They don't get in. Okay, let's try The Smiths. Okay, not that. Then what about The Replacements? And I think that voters kind of sense that of like, well, if they're not even committed enough to really, dig in with one of these, then I don't know. I don't care whether it's this one or that one. And I think that it was a significant moment when The Cure got in, delivered that performance that they delivered. Mm. That was one of those, like, everybody in the room going, okay, I get it. Mm-hmm. No argument. That's a Hall of Fame band that, you started to see that lane open up in a different way, where then Depeche and then Duran and George Michael, from his space. And like that, you sort of saw a crack open up and let a bunch of worthy stuff come through. Mm-hmm. So that's true. Certainly that was true for hip hop. And it was true in that world as well. And I think those moments of, oh, okay, this is Hall of Fame worthy, those are important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Speaking of hip hop, I want to briefly touch, not briefly, I want to begin to talk about Peter Frampton, who will be the subject of this episode for the rest of the conversation. And I guess I just want to start with, I mean, you co-wrote his autobiography, and I would love to know the origins of that.
Yeah, I had the pleasure of co-writing Do You Feel Like I Do with Peter. The origins are really his management, his manager, somebody that I've known a long time, and who was a very big fan of the one other memoir that I have co-written, which was Greg Allman's My Cross to Bear. And I think that they felt that was a simpatico story, at least that was the kind of a story and the kind of approach that they wanted. And they were the ones who contacted me about doing it. And I didn't have, I imagine I'd met Peter, but we certainly didn't have any particular history before that. It was really those guys, bringing us together. They're all those projects are all chemistry. You have the meeting and say, listen, I'm not, nothing personal. Like, if this feels like a good fit to you, then great. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't, then no offense taken. And so we, met a few times just to see if it was felt good to do it. And then we're off to the races working on the book. And he was absolutely a dream to work with. Number one, not just with a particularly good memory for stuff and the ability to articulate what his feelings were through different phases, but also very involved in. I mean, he reread and re-edited every word. He was responsive to every question. He was very hands-on about trying to really, nail everything down on this thing.
A true co-author.
Yeah, and that was great. I mean, these can be very different things. Somebody can be like that, or they can just sort of do the thing and then let you figure it out, and that's fine too. But this felt like, a close collaboration. He was just, super responsible and organized and timely and all the things that, you just appreciate trying to get
very rock and roll.
Yeah.
Organized.
Organized and timely.
Yeah.
Were you a Framp head before this? Were you a...
I was a fan, but honestly...
Is that what his hand...
Yes, it's...
Are they called Fantins? I don't know. I'm trying
clumsy.
To think.
You're doing off the dome.
I'm making it up as I go along. Let's see.
The Framp camp?
The yeah. Framp camp. Were you part of the Framp camp? Good job, Joe.
I was a casual fan for sure. I was not a super fan, which I actually think can be advantageous for these, because I do think that as you've talked to enough people to learn, like, we care about the details so much more than they do, right? They don't think about, they're doing it. They're in the middle. It's like when you read any, the Beatles don't know which songs were on Rubber Soul and which songs were on Revolver. Like, they really have no idea. It's just all happened at that time. And we obsess over all of that stuff. And you go and ask them, they're like, I don't know, And so on the one hand, you want to be informed enough to be able to follow the breadcrumbs and be able to get to the details that the super fans want and, sort of know what to do. But on the other hand, I think you can get lost in the weeds if you're just coming from that, like, it's this one show where this thing, that does not add up to a book that, anybody else particularly wants to read.
Yeah.
So look, I had Frampton Comes Alive when I was a kid. Sure. I knew some of the stuff. I'd seen him, I'd seen him play. I knew the outlines of the story.
Now you really know it.
Yeah. And you know what? We're going to take a quick little break, but when we come back, we will really get into that along with my patented categories. So don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Hey, are you enjoying this episode? Sign up for additional exclusive content on our Patreon at patreon.com/rockhallpod.
Pantheon Podcast listeners, Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house. And my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have, but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out. Because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once. New quick charge function, three customizable sound styles, plus awareness mode. Available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Welcome back to the show, everybody. We hope you had a nice break. We hope over your break, you got the chewing done that you needed to get done.
Okay.
Whatever that means.
I feel like, or you know, you're ready to chime in when needed.
Okay. There's two sides of the same coin. All right. So let's talk about Peter Frampton. And I want to, you know, he has an interesting story leading up to his solo career. You know, born in England in 1950, actually went to school with David Bowie as a youngster, which is, you know, and they would cross paths a few more times over the years.
As a lad.
And as adults as well. But, you know, he was a guy who got into music really early on. And around 16 is when he joined a band called The Herd as their guitarist and singer.
The early stuff really is fascinating because, I mean, look, going to school with David Bowie and singing Buddy Holly songs together on the school steps as kids and all of that stuff is obviously just sort of astonishing as a thing to think about. And we'll come back to what David meant to Peter in his life and then later in his life was, you know, is a really significant part of this story and a really sort of powerful thing. But yes, he joins, you know, he actually, you know, starts to kick around in some of these bands prior to The Herd. And one of his bands is sort of discovered and taken under the wing of Bill Wyman from the Stones when Peter is 15, I think, if I'm remembering the year right. No older than that. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, he tells these stories and you just you're reminded of what a tiny little scene that London rock and roll, you know, swinging London thing was. And he'll talk about being a kid and Wyman, you know, picking him up and driving him in and they go to the Bag of Nails or, you know, these famous clubs. And he'll say, you're sitting there and it's with, you know, he saw Hendrix play with, you know, John Lennon at the next table and Townsend on the other side of him. And he's there with Bill Wyman and the other Stones are there. And he's just like some kid who got dropped into this. But you realize like, it's just this tiny little set of them. And they all hang out together and they're all going to the same bars and they're all going to the same clubs. And if you were inside that, then like, that's what it was. That's where you were. It's just so crazy. And then you think about, you know, Mick, whatever, the Stones showing up at Beatles sessions or John and Paul singing on We Love You or, you know, Jimmy Page playing the sessions with the Kinks and the Who. And like, it's such a, this just little sealed up, you know, tiny community that, you know, that I'm sure in the moment they had no sense of what that was going to mean to history, look like 60 years later.
All of it sounds like scenes in biopics that you wouldn't believe.
Right. That you would say, well, that, like, clearly that's like five different things combined.
Yeah,
into it.
They're They're all hanging out. Okay, great. Sure.
They're all seeing Jimi Hendrix play for the first time in this little club for 200 people, but the Who and the Stones and the Beatles and the Kinks are all there. Like, yeah, right. Except that's
it's
what
just
happened.
Just a mural.
It's a really tacky mural on the side of some venue that everyone laughs at.
You know, and so Peter being just in the middle of this before he's even anything is just such a crazy thing to think about. And then, yes, he's in this band, The Herd, and, you know, sort of beginning a theme that sort of will appear again in his story. He is singled out and put on the cover of one of the teen magazines as the face of 68.
Because he's cute and young.
He's cute and young.
And he's the one they take out of that band and put on the cover, and that basically breaks the band up. And this is not the last time that you get a version of that story from happening in Peter Frampton's life.
Sorry, Frampton.
The Tiger Beat aspect of his looks in opposition with the goals of the serious musician.
Kind of tears that you cry for that, I realize, but it is a thing that will reappear. So that sort of leads to the end of The Herd. But out of that, there's this reshuffling, and then he winds up in a band that is sort of in the process of becoming Humble Pie.
Out of the ashes of the Small Faces.
Out of the ashes of the Small Faces that was initially, he was sort of approached to like, we'll keep the Small Faces, but it'll be, you know, there's a confusing, like trying to retain, because all of those weird where Jimmy Page, you know, is playing in the new Yardbirds, but is the only guy who was in the Yardbirds. But then instead they decide to call it Led Zeppelin. Like, it's kind of one of those situations. They're trying to hang on to the brand. It doesn't really make sense to do that. And out of that, Humble Pie is born. And this, particularly this nexus of, you know, the amazing singer that was Steve Marriott and Peter Frampton on guitar become this sort of powerhouse teaming.
Yeah, an early supergroup almost, you know, because you know these guys from other bands. I mean, The Herd wasn't probably as popular as Small Faces, but they had decent hits on the UK charts.
And again, he was on magazine covers, for better or for worse.
Let's not forget, his status as a teen idol. So Frampton would be with Humble Pie for a few albums from about like 69 to 71. And I would say the song I know most from Humble Pie from this time is from their live album in 71, their cover of I Don't Need No Doctor.
This is the other interesting sort of mirror image thing that happens, is they make some Humble Pie albums. They make, I believe, 4 Humble Pie albums, and are kind of growing but not exploding, and then record a live album, which is the thing that breaks them.
Oof.
That will become exactly the same story that then follows.
Yeah.
And he says, what Peter says and what he says in the book is he knew that the live album was going to be the thing that was going to, you know, really raise their profile, that they'd gotten so good on stage that they were going to be able to capture something, you know, that they were not able to get in the studio, and that was really going to be the thing that was going to make Humble Pie a big deal. And he was sort of faced with the decision of, am I going to stay with this? Because if I'm staying now, it's going to get big. And then that's what I'm doing. And I'm the guitarist in Humble Pie. And by that point, he was having, you know, he was being drawn to the idea of a solo career, being drawn to the idea of more writing, being drawn to the idea of more stuff. Because he was in, again, he's also, you know, sort of concurrently playing on all these sessions in bridges, you know, leading into Humble Pie. But he continues to be in this circle where he plays on All Things Must Pass. You know, he plays on the Harrison record, and he's played on some of the Apple records that those guys produced. He played on this one, Doris Troy, who was a sort of an R&B singer on Apple. George produced her album, had Peter play the guitar parts, you know, on that album. So he's kind of running around in, you know, in that circle, doing stuff with Beatles and Stones and whatever. And I think has a sense of, there's something else that I can be besides the guitar player in this band. So they record
not so rock, humble perhaps.
They record Rock in the Fillmore, which indeed becomes a big hit. I Don't Need No Doctor becomes a big FM radio hit, but he bails out of Humble Pie, I believe before the album comes out, if I'm remembering correctly, certainly before the album hits, very consciously saying, I know this is going to work, and that's why this is the time that I'm going to have to step out.
Yeah. And so that would have been around 1971. And I want to now give some Hall of Fame context for, because now we're hitting, the solo career has begun. The Peter Frampton solo career has begun. So let's do some Hall of Fame context. Because that his debut album as a solo artist, an album called Wind of Change, is from 72. That means he was eligible for the Rock Hall as of 1998. Never been on a ballot before. Had not been involved in an induction ceremony up until last year when he came out to play play along and ripped
a solo that was shredding.
He was shredding with Sheryl Crow for Every Day is a Winding Road. And that, you know, as we say, sometimes you show up, you remind people who you are and what you can do. And now he's on the ballot for the first time this year.
Yeah, I also think that we'll get into all of this as we get into the solo career. But I think that it is what's interesting about, you know, what happens as time passes, right? Is that mm-hmm. people do take, you do take a different perspective and see how somebody continues to resonate or not, see how their sort of reputation and standing rises or falls. And, you know, one thing that we've, certainly that comes up in nominating committee meetings, but I think comes up in all of our brains, is with these sort of career artists, are you judging them in the end by their high points or their low points? Mm-hmm. Or how are you balancing their high points and their low points? And I think we said at the time, if Neil Diamond had never recorded You Don't Bring Me Flowers, would he have gotten into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame 5 years earlier?
Mm-hmm. I believe Paul Simon brings that up in his cheeky little speech inducting him, which I think, as I recall, Neil's speech was like, that song was great. Barbara's right, wonderful. Right, right. She's terrific.
But, you know, these are the, it's, but, you know, but sometimes the, you know, the low point kind of hangs so heavy. Mm. The low points can hang so heavy over somebody's career that you kind of have to wait that out and see. Mm-hmm. And if in the end, the high points then kind of work their way back to the top.
Or you just wait until there are just more artists from the 70s that we can possibly induct. You put them on the ballot. There's
also a strategy.
Not much competition, him and Foreigner. And then you just kind of, you know, let him get in finally.
We'll see. It's true that he's got an open lane on
absolutely.
The ballot.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Sure. But, you know, yes, coming back. I mean, I will say it's not the first time that he's been mentioned in a meeting this mm-hmm. year. So it's mm-hmm. not like this was out of nowhere, but no question, coming back out, playing with Cheryl last year, mm-hmm. you know, sometimes people do that. And there is that feeling of that guy feels like a hall, like yeah. he's in company of Hall of Famers, right?
And Cheryl's, it, you know,
and Cheryl's speech saying, listen, the first rock show I ever went to was to go see Frampton. You know, this is the guy who made me want to do this. That's mm-hmm. why it's such an honor to have him come out and play. Like, you know, of course that stuff is going to register one way or another. So, so it has been a long time, but I think, you know, but I think in 1998, there's no way anybody would have looked and said, we think about this guy as a Hall of Famer. That's before he doesn't win the Grammy, the instrumental Grammy for the Fingerprints album until 2006.
Yeah. Right. So yeah, you're not putting him up against Fleetwood Mac in 1998. You know, right. Right. We've gotten to a point where, he can be considered. Let's get into these categories. These are categories I've concocted because, as we know, the Hall doesn't really publish a list of criteria for the voters to follow. But this is
doesn't publish and doesn't have.
Just... It doesn't have. It's like there's a secret one. Yeah, good point. But you know, So how do we do this? How do we evaluate? This is one way I've kind of reverse engineered to see if an artist is likely to get in the Hall, or you know, if they're worthy. However you want to look at it. And the first category is iconic/majorly recognizable songs. things. And just to give some context before we get into it, Peter Frampton put out 4 studio albums that did not do great. They were not very popular. And obviously, I mean, if anyone knows Peter Frampton, they know about Frampton Comes Alive, the live album in 1976, which his breakthrough. That's where the success came. And I would say it's the 3 singles off this album that are without question his definitive 3 legacy songs. And we'll go in order of when, how he released them. The first single was Show Me the Way. The talk box is front and center.
Yep.
Which would is a kind of hallmark of his sound, certainly for this album. And it went to number 6 on the Hot 100. Very catchy tune, classic rock staple. You could make an argument that this is his most recognizable. I mean, but I'd say, yeah. So show me the way. That's the first one.
Mm-hmm. We're going to do one at a time. So we can do it and then we'll do one at a time. Or
we'll do one at a time. This is, yeah. So yeah, it's like, I mean, I don't want to say anything about Show Me the Way.
No, out of these, that was clearly like the single, right? Mm-hmm. That was the hook. That was the novelty of the talk box. That was a, you know, radio friendly length. Mm-hmm. Of a song, you know, as an introduction to have it shot. It was, you know, the next 2 as well. These were ubiquitous, one right on top of the other, really sort of overlapping. And if we're going to talk about the iconic songs, if we're going to talk about the, you know, the classics within the catalog, this is what we're talking about.
Yeah, that's top of the mm-hmm. heap. I was preparing for this episode today by listening to some Frampton and I don't like it. It is not connecting with me. I've heard these songs too. It's not like, I remember growing, like classic rock radio has existed. My parents grew up in the 70s. My mom is the teenage girl who was like, my mom and Sheryl Crow, I think, are about the same age. Like, I think like I grew up with Frampton kind of in the air, but I was just like, this is, I would never, ever listen to these songs. Like I was like, if they came on the radio, I would change the channel. But I also don't, like, I recognize that other people may like them and that doesn't mean that they are bad, but I'm just like, whew, this is not, it's like catchy enough. And I know we'll get to, you know, Baby, I Love Your Way, which also, you know, maybe got ruined in my life in a different way by the big album cover.
Yes. But
like, you know, like I'm curious about the like societal moment that brought us this live album that was such a breakthrough. Was it just the confluence of like, you know, the novelty of this like new, you know, musical technology in a way, also like him being a handsome person, and then the catchiness of the song? Like
the first thing that I'm super fascinated by is that period of time where live albums were the things that broke these stars. Mm-hmm. Because when you think about it, there's a bunch of them. Obviously Cheap Trick at Budokan is mm-hmm. a similar story. The Allman Brothers at Fillmore is the same. Like they did 2 studio albums that nobody cared about, and it's the live album that got people excited. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a bunch of these, and what a weird moment. Like what was happening at radio where you would think the live stuff would sound weird mixed in mm-hmm. on the radio. Mm-hmm. But in fact, these were they were the things that turned these people into stars. And so I don't have an answer for this, by the way, but like, yeah, what is going on that was not just a document, right? Not just a souvenir of the show, not just a, here's what was mm-hmm. happening at this time for
That's
fans to know, but actually it was the commercial bullseye for a number of these rock bands. That always is weird to me.
Yeah.
And I grew up in it.
Right. It makes me think, I haven't really considered that before, but I'm recalling that like the radio version of Benny and the Jets has a fake live,
audience
intro.
Yeah.
Huh? It's like, yeah, this was clearly like the trend. It was almost like you.
I'm not a big Kiss guy, but Kiss Alive certainly seems it was the thing that like put them into a different.
That's the version
stratosphere,
of,
right? That's the Rock and Roll
I
All Night.
I Want to Rock All Night. Yeah,
right.
Is the live one. That.
I leave that to you for further research, but it's a fascinating, like momentary phenomenon.
Yeah,
that this is the exemplar of, you know, and that's the thing that it isn't that it makes it difficult to talk about Frampton's career, but it's sort of like the first four albums don't matter because this is the like this is where people heard the songs from those albums, right? Like, there's no reason to talk about the recording of "Show Me the studio version." Of Show Me the Way, like it doesn't.
No one's heard it, and
no one's
like,
heard it. No one will hear it.
It's not the definitive version, even close.
This was the thing that wrapped up that whole chapter. So, you know, that's the discussions. So, some of the questions on your criteria list, like, don't even apply because this was the thing that kind of cleared the table and pushed the reset, and that's what you talk about when you talk about his body of work.
Totally. Yeah, no, it's and for the record, just to respond to Kristen, I do think these songs are like impossibly catchy and great classic rock slash pop songs.
And I think we might wind up reversing ourselves when we get to the Foreigner episode. And I'm like, you know what? I think these songs are fun. And you're just like, ah.
No, I don't know. But let's, we've alluded to it already. Let's get to the second single, The Love Song, the song that I think might actually have the honor of being the most recognizable, which is Baby, I Love Your Way.
Most recognizable as noted because of not one, but two.
Yes. So let me lay that.
Impossibly cheesy and impossibly successful covers.
Yeah, let me lay that out here. Let me give the context here. So, you know, this is Love Song. There's no talk box on this one. Went to number 12 on the Hot 100. You know, a beautifully written song. And then in 1988, a dance group called Will to Power covered the song.
Pause on that band name for one second.
Will to Power. They covered the song as part of a little bit of a medley with the song Freebird. And they take it to number one. They take and that is, yeah, it is very cheesy. It is very 80s. I will say, even though that is the chart-wise, the biggest success, I think to this day, the version I hear the most out in the wild, weirdly enough, is the like dub reggae
Big
version
Mountain.
By the group Big Mountain from the Reality Bites soundtrack in 1994.
Ooh, baby, I love your way every day. Yeah, yeah. Ooh,
that is one that just like that is a ubiquitous song in my lifetime. I just feel like it's not good, but
I certainly don't like it.
It's not good, but it's like now I can hear it in my head. It's like it's got a hold on my psyche, and I'm mad about it. And I can go back and blame Peter Frampton for this.
You can,
and
I suppose that's true. I will say that the as he tells the story, the Will to Power thing, as god awful as it is, was an absolute godsend to him because it was at a very bad time in his career. And not only was that a big hit, but they did not clear the publishing. And so they had to give him all the money.
Wow. That's right. Yeah. If you don't do your due diligence, you can take all the publishing.
And it's some ridiculous, like, it's a mix that they did, like, to play at like, it was a wedding band. And they did this, for, you know, and it just sort of then broke on local radio, I think, in Florida, and then became this thing. And so I think they didn't even, like, think about, oh, it's a real thing, and we need to go and clear the publishing and make this legal. And then when it exploded, he ended up just keeping all of that money.
Oof.
Oh, my God.
And I will say, you know, looking at the Spotify numbers is interesting on this because the Will to Power version has 46 million. The Frampton Live version has 87 million. And the Big Mountain version has 286 million.
That's what I'm saying. Dab on them. Go ahead.
I mean,
insane.
It's really, and like, as someone who listens, I like listen to a lot of terrestrial radio. And so I feel like I get a good sense of what is being played. And like that version, because also it is, you know what it is immediately, because they don't start with music. They start with an a cappella, just, ooh, baby, I love your way. And it an immediate fingers going straight to the next number to get that out of here. But that is like, for, I think, a generation, like the definitive version. It's kind of crazy, but Big Mountain.
Oof.
All right.
A band that I don't know one thing about, and I don't think they've done anything else of note.
Well, they have a best of album.
Good for them. All right.
Wow. So that's number two.
Yeah. And then the third single off Frampton Comes Alive is Do You Feel Like We Do? Song that is 14 minutes long, occasionally edited down to a brisk 7.
Yes.
For radio, you know, the classic rock station I listened to growing up, I think, played the full version, you know.
Well, he said, you know, Peter, they did the edit, which, as you note, an edit that's 7 minutes long and was still a pop hit.
Yeah.
But that really most radio, certainly most FM radio, stayed with the full expansive 14, 15 minute version. Yes.
Yeah, and this is it's a real jam kind of song. You know, a lot of talk box on this one.
Yeah, I can't. I mean, if Kristen doesn't want to put in the time on this one, there's no arguing.
No, I mean, I listen.
There just isn't. Either you're on for that ride or you're not on for that ride.
I tried. I got off. I mean, I was on it. It's just, I don't like it. I do not like this man's music. And that is, I do not say that as I am the arbiter of what is good and what is bad, but I am the arbiter of what I like and I don't like. And I do not like this music. I was actually thinking about it because I was really like, when our show first started, I was quite mean about the Moody Blues on the regular because I was so bored during their like kind of performance. I was just like, what's going on? And I didn't know, I wasn't kind of in context at the time. And Joe did like an entire like Moody Blues episode where he just like brought me along and was like, here's stuff. And I remember listening to it and I was like, I could see how you could like this. And like, I'm still never going to put a Moody Blues right. record on, except for maybe in your wildest dreams. But that's just a nostalgic moment for me. But like, I was thinking about that today because I was like, oh, like, I don't even have that with Frampton. Like I can't, it missed me completely. Again, I understand that this mm-hmm. continues to be very popular. People like Frampton, my mom, Sheryl Crow, Joe Quazzala, you know, that they're out there. They're just, it's not for me. It's not.
There's not an argument for that or with that. And I think especially, again, when you get to the full, you know, the full jam, when you get to Do You Feel Like We Do, which was only going to come as that was not going to be the first single.
Obviously.
Right? Yeah. It was not going to be the second single, but it could be the third single.
His powers were so great.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's like, well, let's see if we can get away with this one.
Yeah. You know, it's just, you've just got to be, that's got to be what you're agreeing to. It's, you know.
I guess you could say Kristen did not feel like they did.
Like they did.
I did not. I guess it's kind of giving me like the Who, but Who? Like, it's not doing it for me. It's like, it's missing. I don't enjoy it. It feels, I don't like the talk box and I don't like the way that the songs sound. And
I think you've formally registered your complaint. We don't have to dwell on it anymore. One thing, you know, like you said, Alan, all these songs come from studio albums that nobody knows, you know, these become the definitive versions. But I just wanted to point out this one comes from an album/project called Frampton's Camel, which was also the name of the band and the name of the record.
And also the name of his fan club.
There you go. We're all camels.
They're camel. It's like Gaga's got the monsters, Frampton's got the camel.
But my fun note about that band, Frampton's Camel, is that the bassist, Rick Wills, was in Foreigner and is nominated with them this year and has a writing credit on this song. Do you feel like we do?
Is Frampton nominated as a solo artist?
He is nominated as a solo artist.
Correct. Yeah. He's not nominated as Frampton's Camel.
Yes.
You never know. Sade is a band.
That's true. But in terms of the legacy songs for Frampton, that is it. It's these three songs off of this album. And obviously the album was a great success, spent 10 weeks at the top of the charts, was the best-selling album of 1976. One of the best-selling live albums in general, more than 20 million sales worldwide.
The best-selling album of 1976 and one of the best-selling albums of 1977.
Oh, wow. That's right. Yeah. It stayed atop for so long.
Yeah.
But I have to admit, I have never heard another Peter Frampton song. And what's kind of bizarre is that technically his biggest chart hit was off of his next album. And it was the title track from 1977's I'm In You.
I'm in you. You're in me.
Any conversation about Peter Frampton really rests on, there has never been, certainly in the rock and roll business, anybody who got to the highest of highs and the lowest of lows with the velocity that it happened to Peter. Mm-hmm. This was a rocket ship going straight up and coming straight down. Oof. And it's, again, a lot of it comes down to, as mentioned with The Herd, where he gets singled out and put on the cover as the face of 68, is there's a big push of Peter Frampton heartthrob.
Mm-hmm.
And he can run this list. He did a Rolling Stone cover where they talked him into taking his shirt off. He did I'm In You was the follow-up, which he says is a crappy album that they rushed him to make. He had no time to recover and process from the phenomenon of Frampton Comes Alive, was just pushed back out to make a record and made a half-assed record where the lead single was a ballad and the cover is this open flowy blouse that he is wearing. That was, I remember it when it had mocked universally. And, he said it was a very delicate, as the tour went on and got bigger and bigger, it went from seeing all guys in the front and the few girlfriends who were there in the back to seeing all the screaming girls up front and the guys, the rock and roll guys in the back. And
also that was the decade or the generation, especially. I mean, we're still working on it, but anything that young girls like is denigrated
absolutely.
Pop culture and particularly in rock music and
a rock and roll guitar player guy.
In the 70s?
Yeah.
So it was, I'm In You is one of the all-time legendary bombs. And combined with that, he goes and makes the Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band film with the Bee Gees.
Yes.
The three Bee Gees and Peter the four. We don't have time.
Not enough time, but yes,
it's called Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
I'm sorry, what?
It's a famously misguided attempt to make a Beatles movie without the Beatles.
A script either, by the way.
Also tends to be an issue with filmmaking.
Okay. People are on drugs. I get it. It's okay.
This was one of the all-time biggest, too big to fail projects of all time. The Bee Gees and Peter Frampton were the biggest stars in the world. They were going to sing the biggest songs in the world. And this was a disaster of monumental proportions. And the 1-2 punch of the Sgt. Pepper movie and the I'm In You album absolutely exploded this career into bits.
Yeah. And it's funny, you say I'm In You bombed, but it's funny that there was enough residual love from Frampton Comes Alive that song, the title track, went to number 2.
Yes.
Which is his highest charting. But it's also funny that I've never heard that song in my life. Just as someone
It was the follow-up to Frampton Comes Alive. It was the record, everybody was waiting.
People
and it was coming
it.
After all this stuff. And it's a mess. And
it is
and
evaporated from our culture.
It's a and it's a sappy ballad, which was a ridiculous thing to do for a guy who had a couple of years earlier been rumored to possibly be joining the Rolling Stones as the new guitar player.
Crazy.
We went from that to the guy with that haircut and that open shirt singing a sappy ballad as his new single. And it was, you know, it's when I say, okay, so we're talking about Hall of Fame. Are we judging him from 1976 and Frampton Comes Alive being literally the biggest album in the world, or 1978 when this movie and this album are, you know, actual punchlines?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and as we're kind of closing out this category of recognizable songs, it's like, you know, he put out a few more. He would continue to put out music, and maybe he would have something you could call a modest hit here and there until the end of the 70s. But, you know, again, there is nothing anybody would ever really hear on the radio now, or anything anybody would remember just from it being around. It kind of peters off.
Nice. Look, the other, I may be breaking from your category.
No, it's okay. Go
sort
ahead.
Of the other project that I think that you need to look at when you're talking, this isn't something that you would have heard on the radio. Mm-hmm. We can return to it, but at a low point in his career, his old friend David Bowie calls him up and asks him to come play on the album that would be Never Let Me Down, and then the Glass Spider tour. He was the lead guitar player, and, you know, he feels like this really resurrected him from being completely forgotten and recentered him as a guitar player. And what happens after that is it's not about being, you know, a pop star, mm-hmm. that kind of performer. It's about being an instrumentalist. And a lot of the Pearl Jam, Soundgarden, those guys all come out and really claim him as an early influence, as a big impact on, you know, them choosing to play and learning to play guitar. In 2006, he releases an instrumental album called Fingerprints that wins the Grammy for Best Instrumental Performance. And a lot of those guys play on it, and Warren Haynes mm-hmm. plays on it, and, you know, lots of legendary guitar players are on there with him. And that, to him, in some ways, he would say is sort of, you know, more important to him than Frampton Comes Alive, because it recognized him and established him as a musician, not just as like a teen pop phenom, that enabled him to then go have the rest of his career. So it wasn't a radio hit. You wouldn't know it from that.
Right,
That's what the project was. But that winning the Grammy and getting the attention and the critical attention that it did is sort of this other, that's the other sort of landmark piece for him.
Good to know. Yeah, I feel like I did not really register that, but that's an interesting comeback for him. Let's go to the next category, albums that are considered all-time classics. So obviously, like, there's
start the list. You got Frampton Comes Alive.
Frampton's Camel.
I'd say the only other thing, again, it's not the solo project. I mean, the Humble Pie, Rockin' the Fillmore album is certainly within certain rock communities. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you ask like the Black Crowes, they'll tell you that's one of the greatest records ever made.
Sure.
So, you know, that always with the, like, how strictly we're saying solo versus playing on the other things.
Are
that's
we
the other
that
one.
Into account in
yeah, yeah, that's the other thing that I think you would put up as a, you know, a long lasting sort of contribution. Album.
Yeah. Now, Alan, have you ever voted for the Rolling Stone 500 list?
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Yeah. Because my question is going to be, and this is what we do to kind of bridge the album category to the critical acclaim category. Do you guys think any Frampton albums are on the Rolling Stone, any iteration of the Rolling Stone 500 greatest albums list?
I would think not, if I'm guessing. I would think there were probably some votes for Frampton Comes Alive from certain voters, you know, of a certain age, generation, and sensibility. It was a, you know, a sort of moment that, if not an era defining album, certainly a moment defining album in that way. Even then, it was not like a critical favorite that was going to get, you know, that. Mm-hmm. So,
what do you think, Kristen?
Well, here's the thing. I had his Wikipedia page open, so I know I saw something. I'm not sure if I saw it correctly, but I have a feeling that there is one. I would have said yes, just on the old list, anyway, because it just that feels right. But maybe I don't know what his critical, it seems like what was his critical, I guess we'll get into that in a minute,
Right,
but like
right.
without really know, I mean, it sounds like, you know, with this rocket ship that went straight up and then absolutely combusted on, you know, very quickly, that he wasn't like, you know, beloved by the critics or whatever, but I still just think like that album is huge among boomers, and they were making the lists, especially the early 2000s lists. I don't think there's one anymore in 2020, but I think if there was one, it would be on like the earlier list. And
So, Alan is correct. It is not on any iteration of the Rolling Stone list, and that will take this conversation to the critical acclaim discussion, which is, you know, Alan's right. It's not like this was ever considered to be an amazing artistic achievement. It was very popular, and sometimes just through sheer popularity, an album can make it onto these lists. But no. Never. And I think that speaks to some critical ambivalence. You know, we look sometimes, especially because his archive is very searchable, we look at Robert Christgau to see what he's got to say. And on
oh, it was a different. They mentioned
Okay,
all-time favorite live albums in the
sure. Yeah, and that's going to be in the conversation.
wiki. That makes sense.
But
Yeah.
here's Robert Christgau on I'm in You, which of course is
Well,
it's going to be
which
brutal.
nobody likes.
Yeah,
So.
nobody likes, but Frampton is a medium snazzy guitarist taking no chances on an absurdly saleable formula.
That's almost a generous read of I'm in You. That's the
Right,
like
yeah.
base. That's the sort of baseline, you know. Like you could be a lot meaner about that record than
And
that
maybe Frampton himself would
is.
even be meaner, it seems like. But yeah, you know, I don't see the. You know, Alan, you mentioned that the kind of later demonstrations of guitar ability had maybe a little more love critically, but yeah, I wouldn't position him as a critical darling even at his height, which, you know, may have been complicated by that Tiger Beat issue that
Yeah,
we
I
talked
think that's
about.
right. Now, look, he has champion. I mean, Cameron Crowe is the big Frampton champion over the years, including that he wrote the liner notes to Frampton Comes Alive. So he was on board even before that exploded.
Right, yeah.
All those millions of copies that people bought had Cameron's, you know, words there. But he has also, you know, kept him around. I mean, Peter was an on-set consultant for Almost Famous.
Right.
Cameron brought him in to teach the actors what would a rock star in 1976 do? You know, how did they set up the amps? How would you wear your guitar? What was, you know, he was sort of there to do rock star lessons to, you know, for the actors in that film. And you know, so Cameron is always somebody who has talked him up, you know, and kept him around. And again, in the later years, I do feel like, you know, a lot of people have come around because he's the nicest guy in the world, you know, and a
Sure.
survivor and has contributed, you know, played with so many people, so many sessions, so many records. And again, this sort of reframing. I would say, even the one thing I would say to you, Kristen, and you might hate this, but he did the last album that he did, he's finishing a new album. The last album that he did was an instrumental album called Frampton Forgets the Words. And he did instrumentals of very interesting. He did a Radiohead song, he did a Lenny Kravitz song, he did like an interesting mix of things to cover. The one thing that from that Fingerprints record that people may have heard is he does a pretty fantastic Black Hole Sun cover that he did with some of the Soundgarden guys. And those have been the opportunity to really listen to this guy as a player, right? To get
Yeah, I
outside
mean,
of all the other stuff, whatever, and just listen to a guitar player play.
when
And
I
if
saw,
that's your thing, there's a lot that's rewarding in those.
to be honest, it's not really my thing.
Yeah, that's
But
fine.
also,
Nice
but
try.
I'm like, no, but also, what I will say, like, I have very goodwill toward Frampton based almost entirely on last year's induction ceremony, which he was such a bright spot and was truly having a great time and just shredded, was amazing and thrilled to be there. And that is like, that will just kind of, you know, I bear him no ill will. I have goodwill toward him.
Understood. But understanding like, what the resistance.
If I ever had to listen to a Frampton song, I'd really be, it wouldn't be my favorite. You know, I like him though.
Okay, good. So all right, let's breeze through some of these other categories. Commercial success. I mean, it's all pretty much concentrated around Comes Alive, which was, as we've said, a colossal hit, you know, I think 20 million records or something, you know, and that's, you know, that's kind of the totality of it. You know, nothing ever even got close to reaching those heights, but you can't say that that album wasn't a hit.
And again, what's so weird about this, that conversation, like we said, is that being, because it's the thing that wraps up the four albums that precede it, right? Like it's the massive moment of that, but how do you even, like when you look across the catalog, you sort of chop off that whole first part of it because it's rendered redundant by what Comes Alive is.
Yeah. It's almost like those are the songs Peter's version.
Right.
Let's go to the next category, longevity, which, you know, we've been talking about to some degree. It's like he was very, very popular for, what do we want to say, 2 years? And then like the drop off came. So that's, I think that's a bit of a hurdle for him in this conversation. You know, obviously he continued to make music and perform live, but it's kind of the long cycle of that one album that's his imperial phase.
I think, again, a little bit how you define longevity. I mean, certainly there's commercial longevity, but then there is the, okay, then, you know, Bowie takes him back out and he tours as a featured performer with Bowie and he plays on that record and he plays, you know, and he does the instrumental stuff that he does and he's done the other sessions and he continues to tour like sort of relentlessly for a long time. So it's not the scale. On the one hand, it's not this nowhere near the scale of what the peaks are, but he does continue to stay out there, continue to do stuff, continue to show up in sort of sometimes interesting places, you know, over a long time. That's what I'm like, in 1998, nobody would have thought about Hall of Fame.
Yeah,
but,
no, it's
but,
true.
But in those 20 whatever years since then, there is a different frame, you know. It's always going to be, the frame is always going to be Frampton Comes Alive, but you're looking at it, I think, through a different lens of somebody who did recreate himself, did sort of open a different lane for himself, and was recognized, as we've said, from a lot of these, you know, these 90s rock guys as somebody who was important to them.
Well, that's, I'm glad you brought that up, because the next category is influence. Thanks. And when I was looking at this, I don't exactly hear it. You know, and we have Sheryl Crow mentioned it was her first concert. So there's that. And then if you think about the talk box, I guess, like, I don't exactly know.
Yeah,
I wouldn't say that like Daft Punk, for example, was like drawing from Frampton Comes Alive exactly. Although there's certainly some sonic similarities. But yeah, I guess some of these 90s grunge guys, according to your research, have brought him up. And so I guess that's where it.
Well, have brought him up and have worked with
him. Have worked with him, yeah.
You know, and it's a little bit like, you know, it ventures a little bit into sort of the Kiss argument, right? I mean, that's...
How can you be that big that you don't have some sort of influence?
And that, you know, it was, you know, I mean, it was Tom Morello specifically, but then it was all of those guys saying, Kiss are why I picked up a guitar. That is where I learned what this is. That is the reason I do it. And I think there's a certain amount of that if you're that age of, you know, the 90s, the guys who broke through in the 90s, that was what a rock star was, you know, was, if not your first, certainly a very early and very central exposure to, hey, here's a guy who plays a guitar and is, you know, this level of massive superstar, you know, and playing 14-minute instrumental jams, not like, you know, and you can do that and be really big. And I think that those guys, you know, will say that was a thing that registered for them. That's the credit that they'll give. I don't know that it's a specific, you know, something in his playing that they draw from. I think it's more that idea of, that's where we saw what this was about.
Mm-hmm. The next category is artistry slash skill. You know, it's come up already. He's a good songwriter. He's a good singer. He's a good guitar player. Like, he's triple threat, I guess you could say, in that regard. And I wanted to just, there's a fun little story that, speaking of guitar player, that I just wanted to bring up, that I love the story that he had this special guitar that he liked to play throughout the 70s that was presumed lost in a cargo plane crash, but then they found it and returned it to him in 2011.
It's a fantastic story that we weave through. It's how the book opens. And then because every few years, you know, he plays the same guitar on Rock of the Fillmore and Frampton Comes Alive. It's the mm-hmm. same guitar on both of those albums. And it is the guitar he's holding on the Frampton Comes Alive cover. I mean, everybody sees it. Like, it's the gatefold.
Mm-hmm. It's
and
iconic,
that's
yeah.
the one he's holding up. And that thing went down in a plane crash, that the plane burned up and everything was presumed lost in South America. And he just assumed, okay, that's it. You know, that all the equipment is gone. And then a few years later, somebody kind of mentions there's a pawn shop in Colombia, not even in the same country, but in the neighboring country. And then they may have it and they try and follow up, but then it's a dead end and they can't get through it. And then somebody else goes and there's another. The thing becomes, it was somehow thrown from the plane, snatched up, grabbed by somebody. They held onto it in a closet for however many years. They took it to a pawn shop or a music shop, tried to trade it in. And somehow somebody who worked in the music shop figured out this was from that plane crash, figured out what it was. Then they contact him. They go through all the FBI is involved because they don't want to turn it over because they're afraid they're going to get arrested for stealing it. So they have to broker this whole, it'll be accompanied and the cops will do the thing. And then they have to authenticate. But it did come back to him, you know, however many years later. And this, the Phoenix, risen from the ashes. Is the guitar. It's an amazing story.
It's really, it's so, so improbable and really, really fun. All right, let's get to the last category. Sometimes the most important category, because it speaks to the ubiquity of an artist, which is, does my mom know who they are? And this one, I mean, Kristen, you've already naturally answered it throughout the episode. But yeah, my mom knows, she's also the right age for this. And like, yeah, especially if you were around in the 70s, you know who Peter Frampton is. He was colossal. But also, because he's been such a classic rock staple, I think he's just widely known. Like,
and it's worth noting, appeared on The Simpsons.
Mm-hmm. Yes, a great episode, Homer Palooza. It's yes. a really good one.
Appeared in a story arc on Madam Secretary.
Oh. I didn't know that one.
they hired him to be the wedding band. It's, I don't know, something.
Okay.
So, and then there's another one. There's a couple of those. Like, there, again, because he is so representative of this sort of time and place. Yeah. That's been called on to show right. up in some different, you know, TV series.
That's really funny. Yeah. I mean, like, I'm sure there's a generation of people who, I mean, I probably for the first time heard about Peter Frampton from The Simpsons before I was like getting into that kind of music. But yeah, he's present. All right, let's get to the verdict. And if you, you know, Danielle abstained from this part just because of her position on the nominating committee, you can choose what you want to do, Alan. But it's, you know, should Peter Frampton get in the Hall of Fame? Will he, and will it be this year? And we can start with Kristen. And Kristen, you don't need to dwell on the first part of this question for too long.
Yeah. And I won't. I mean, I've said it before. I think that Frampton seems like a cool guy. I understand why people like him. I understand all of that. When I put his three songs from the one album that are incredibly, you know, like still around and have a lot of longevity up against kind of, you know, the idea of, is this a Hall of Fame career? I think no. And that is just, this feels to me a little bit like we're just really scraping out the 70s at this moment. And that, you know, he's got a lot of goodwill from last year, and I think like a lot of people would like to see him in, and you know, do I think he should get in? No, I'd rather there be more space for other people, but also the hall is infinite. I don't care. Put him in. Will he get in? I think odds are good. I think the lane is pretty open for him right now. It really depends on how many voters have still a bad taste in their mouth based on kind of, his decline. And also, it also depends on how many newer voters are familiar with him or have enough of an affinity with him. Like how many of them grew up watching the Homer Palooza episode of The Simpsons and are like, oh, that guy, I can't believe he's not in. Because he does in some ways have that feeling of, oh, that guy's not in.
That's how he announced his own nomination on his Twitter was, wait, I'm not already in the Rock Hall, which was a cheeky little reference to that very phenomenon.
And so that I think bodes very well for him getting in. So I think he will get in this year.
Alan, do you wish to participate?
I mean, I'll say I'm not going to answer between my involvement with Peter and my involvement with the Hall of Fame. I don't really know how to,
Yes.
But it's such an interesting and such a weird ballot this year. That's very, very hard. I mean, I don't know how you've been doing as you've been going through. I find it very hard to predict and anticipate how these votes are going to fall. For almost everybody, I could see Oasis walking in and I could see Oasis getting zero votes. Both of those are totally plausible to me.
I think you're right.
And he is in an inch. He does have kind of an open lane. I think Kristen's absolutely right as a sort of 70s rock god, Foreigner a little bit, Ozzy a little bit, but, not the full on hard stuff. That there's a space that's open for him. There's a lot of he's very well liked.
Yes.
He's very well, respected. Again, he's worked with a lot of people we have not mentioned. And I feel bad in a way mentioning it, but, Peter's really sick. Mm-hmm. He has this muscular degenerative disease that he did a farewell tour prior to 2020 because he felt like I'm not going to be able to keep playing well enough. He's like, I'll do it as long as I feel like I'm really representing myself up there, but I'm not going to go and play if I'm not up to it. Mm-hmm. And he did a full farewell tour and then came lockdown and everything else. And he came out and was like, I can keep going. And he's gone back out and done more dates. You saw he played sitting down in the ceremony last year. He plays sitting down when he's touring. He's walking with a cane, but he is well enough to still be out there and playing. How do you, can you be heartless enough not to at least, recognize the emotional appeal of that? But I think, you ask the right questions, which are A, those who are old enough to remember, to some of them, do they still feel like he's kind of a punchline from, what the 70s became? And for those who are younger, do they know who he is? Do they have a relationship to this guy? Those are 100% the right things to ask and 100% things that I don't know the answer to.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you just said about being heartless, it's like the sympathy and like the ramping up from last year, I think really is going to result in him getting in. That is my prediction. I think everything we've said, like, how is he not already in? He just has the type of name recognition as a true rock and roll artist that is going to serve him lane clearing as well. And the fact that he can still play, but, he's not in peak physical health.
He's going to show up
he's going to show up. Yeah.
And we are going to all have feelings watching this person in decline who's still, out there, like giving it their all and putting their heart into the music.
And it's a nice story.
I'll just plug that we did have Peter on our Sound Up podcast the week that the nominations were announced. And I mean, not surprisingly, he just, he couldn't have a better attitude about all of this.
Yes, absolutely.
Again, part of it is, I guess I'm not in already, but he's also like, look, I'm honored for this. The fact that I got this recognition while I'm here to get it, I take nothing for granted. I still have there's still another step in this process. And if it doesn't happen, I'm going to be fine with that. He was his own, he was his own very charming self, with a great spirit and a great attitude about this and everything else. I mean, for having made peace with what that the most dramatic rise and fall in rock and roll history was to come out of that, pick up the pieces and figure out how to go on with your life puts you in a certain, you know, there's a certain kind of a mental state, I think, that you then go about the rest of your days with.
Yeah. And to continue to have a good attitude about it. It's just like he's a hard person to root against. That being said, I don't exactly, based on my own kind of measurements, I don't think he has had a Hall of Fame worthy career. I think if you could criticize me in this show, it would be that I'm maybe a little too nice. And I'm just like, yeah, sure. It's, you know, put them in. But, you know, I do think you have to draw a line somewhere. I think it is. Three songs off of one album, that is the legacy. I don't think that is quite enough, but I am not going to be mad if he gets in. I mean, like you say, I have a human heart. So like I think it'll be a great induction. And I know you got to get going, but quickly, when he is inducted, whether it's this year or whatever, let's talk about who should give the speech to induct. I think there's some obvious people. You mentioned Cameron Crowe. That seems like someone who could, if he's not given the speech, he should at the very least be writing it. And then, you know, Sheryl Crow also. I mean, we got two crows.
Oh, two crows.
Yeah, the crows are really leading the pack here.
And you then know, the black crows put back him up on stage.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, Cheryl, nearly, like, that's, she started to give the speech a little bit, you know, when she was doing her own speech.
I mean, that's what, I feel like if you asked Peter to choose, he would probably pick Cheryl to do it. I mean, I know that they're friendly, that he really has, you know, been very, very grateful for her support.
Well, and you know,
enthusiasm,
he showed up for her, she'll show up for him.
Yeah, but I think it's too redundant. It's too close to last year. And the fact that she talked about him in her speech, like, what's she going to do? Say again, this was the first show I went to. Like, we've already heard that. So that's the only reason I would think that it wouldn't be her, is just too close to what we already got. Cameron would be fantastic if they feel like that's enough of a name and enough of a draw. You know, and then you think about the others. I mean, so many of the people that he played, you know, obviously if he could choose anybody from the history of his life, it would have been Bowie. But, you know, it's not that. It's, you know, it's not going to be Ringo. But like,
I was going to say that's an outside, because he did do a year with Ringo's All Star Band, and so that's,
and recorded multiple times with Ringo. You know, was in, and then in that same set toured with the All Stars. You know, that's again unlikely for any number of reasons, but you know, that's out there. You know, and again, then I don't know if it's any of these, again, the sort of grunge guys who do talk about him. I mean, the Pearl Jam guys recorded with him. You know, the Soundgarden guys did, you know, McCready and Matt Cameron, and like, those guys are all fans. So that's not out of the realm.
Well, you know, it's been a while since we've gotten Eddie Vedder induction speech. He used to do it all the time. Maybe it's time for him to come back.
Or I guess I'm just like, is there a movie star who was kind of growing up in that time who could do like a Drew Barrymore, you know,
or like Charlize,
Charlize. Or,
I mean, because of the Almost Famous thing would be the other, does that, you know, does
Billy Crudup.
Does Kate Hudson do, well, Billy Crudup, like, though, he was working hands-on with Billy Crudup.
I believe
this is how you hold a guitar. So, you know, it'd be an excuse to tell that story.
Yeah. And the kind of the last thing we usually talk about, which maybe is a little bit redundant, which is like, would he play? I think
what
absolutely. And then what three songs? Ha ha ha. I think we know. I think the perfect, you know, set list is the order they release. You start with Show Me the Way, you do Baby I Love Your Way, and then you end on the jamming out to Do You Feel Like We Do. I mean, that's just, I see no other way.
They ain't giving him the 14 minutes for it, but yeah.
Yeah, you'll find a way to work at some of it. And I think that's going to do it. Thank you, Alan, so much for your time. I really appreciate it. If you would like to plug anything, whether it's Sound Up or the book or whatever.
Yeah, book is too. I mean, from this conversation, if you're a fan, maybe you're aware of Peter Frampton's book, Do You Feel Like I Do? But if you want to know more, that's where to go. Our podcast, Sound Up with Mark Goodman and Alan Light, comes out two times a week on all major podcast distributors and platforms. And if you want to go back and hear Frampton talk about some of this stuff, again, a couple of weeks ago, we had him on to do that. So you can still find that. And otherwise just grinding away.
I love it. Well, we thank you so much again. This was really, really great. Our listeners know they can follow us at Rock All Pod on Instagram and Twitter. Email us rockallpod@gmail.com. I believe by now, when this is released, the Patreon might be live. We're going to start talking to voters and see who they're picking on their ballot. That will be available at patreon.com/rockallpod. Thank you to Mike Lloyd for the logo, Yusuf Kim for the music, and Pantheon Podcast for hosting us. I'm Joe Quazala.
I'm Kristen Studdard.
And who cares
about the Rock Hall?
You almost screwed it up.
I know.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.